All right, today is March 5th, 2013. This is an oral history interview with Millard Sussman. I am here with Dan Liu, and I am Troy Reeves. I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program here on campus. Millard, for sound recording purposes, could you say your name and then spell your last name?
Millard Sussman, S-U-S-M-A-N.
Thank you. I'm going to get this a little closer to you. Dan and I may have to speak up. We're not yelling at you. We're just trying to make sure our questions get heard. Millard, we gave you a list of possible topics before this interview, so we want to start off, if you wouldn't mind, talking about your early life as a fledgling biologist or a fledgling scientist.
Well, I don't know exactly when I became a fledgling scientist. I took a terrific biology course when I was in high school. I guess it was 10th grade. From a teacher that I liked very much, and I loved the genetics section of that high school course. And at that time, I decided that I thought biology was pretty cool, and I thought I might want to be a biologist. But my parents were pretty insistent that they wanted me to be a physician. Anyway, I started off, I think, at college at the I went to Washington University in St. Louis after having graduated from a high school in St. Louis. And I started off as a psychology major. I decided after a semester of psychology that the guy who was teaching the course was the chair of the department, and I thought, if this is the state of the art of psychology, I'm not taking this. So I became a zoology major and loved the genetics portions of the courses that I took, and I eventually decided that I really wanted to go into genetics. I applied to medical school to make my parents happy when I got to my senior year, and I was admitted to medical school, and I got a scholarship to medical school. And then around May of that year, in which I had been admitted to medical school at Washington University Medical School, I went to my research advisor, who was guiding me in a senior research project at Washington U, and I said, you know, there's no way I really want to practice medicine. I'm not sure why I'm going to medical school. And he said, what, are you crazy? Why would you go to medical school if you're not interested in being a physician? So I told my parents I wasn't going to medical school, and I told the dean I wasn't going to medical school. The dean of the medical school called my mother and said, take him to a psychiatrist.
Even though you've taken a psychiatry course.
Yeah. So anyway, that's the story of how I got out of medical school and I went to graduate school. I did a year of graduate study at Wash U, and then I went to Caltech and completed my work in genetics there.
Thank you. A follow-up to that, well, actually it sort of leads into what you just finished with. If you could describe a little bit about what it was like being a graduate student in genetics in the 50s and 60s.
Well, it was terrific. Yeah, this was when I started as an undergraduate at Washington University, DNA wasn't mentioned in any of the genetics courses or any of the biochemistry courses. By the time I graduated in 1956, people actually knew that DNA was an important molecule. They thought it might be the genetic material, but it wasn't in any of the textbooks that we were using. So this was an exciting time. You know, people were beginning to understand what biology was all about. Molecular biology was just coming into its own. I knew by the time I was a senior in college that microbial genetics was where all of the action in molecular biology was going on at the time, and that the gene was really being analyzed and understood at the level of its fine structure and its biochemical activity. So I decided I wanted to do microbial genetics, and when I applied to graduate school, I applied here Josh Lederberg was a faculty member here, and I applied at Caltech, where I knew that Max Delbrick was a member of the faculty. And both of them were outstanding leaders in the field, and I got into both graduate schools. And Lederberg wrote me a letter telling me that I seemed to be pretty smart, but you had to be more than smart to be a good scientist, and that he was leaving and going to Stanford. So I decided, well, if he was going to Stanford, I'd go to Caltech, because I wasn't sure what else was here at Wisconsin at the time. And I went to Caltech and became a microbial geneticist.
Millard, could you then describe that you applied here, but you eventually obviously ended up here. So I wonder if you could talk about the path that brought you here as a faculty.
Well, I had a man named Ray Owen, who was a graduate of the University of Wisconsin graduate program as a professor at Caltech, and he was sort of a avuncular type. Whenever I had complaints about my professor, who was kind of an SOB, I would go to Ray and cry on his shoulder, and Ray would comfort me. And when I got my degree, Ray was on my thesis committee. He thought my thesis was pretty good, although the research turned out to be a total bust because it was based on an assumption that wasn't true. But it had a glorious, heavily mathematical background, and it was kind of interesting to everybody, except that it turned out to be useless. But Ray put in a good word for me here, and I was invited, as I was heading off to do a postdoctoral stint in England, I stopped here and gave a seminar on my research and met the faculty here in genetics. And then they offered me a job on the basis primarily of Ray Owen's recommendation. So I had help right out of graduate school.
Millard, I'm dying to ask a question about the SOB, but I think we probably should continue moving forward. I think Dan has a question about your time here, early on your time here.
Well, actually, if you don't mind, can I ask you about your dissertation work? Mm. I mean, you just described it as something you were pretty excited about. You thought it had promise.
It's not going to sound terribly exciting when I tell you what it was all about, but I'll tell you.
Well, you were excited.
When you infect bacteria with bacterial viruses, you can infect a bacterium with many viruses. You can get 10 viruses into the bacterium, and they all replicate inside the bacterium, and when they come out, when the bacterium pops and releases a progeny of viruses, all of the genotypes of the ingoing bacteria are represented among the offspring. So the parents of the viruses that come out are not just one or two of the viruses that went into the bacterium. They were all of the viruses that went into the bacterium. And the question that my professor wanted answered, and we figured out how to answer that question, was when recombination occurs between the chromosomes that enter from the viruses, how many viruses can interact simultaneously to make a recombinant progeny molecule, or progeny chromosome? Do matings occur two by two, or can three or four or five viruses participate in a mating inside of a bacterium, a recombinational interaction? And so that was the question I was addressing, and the answer I got was two, which is what my professor, Max, wanted me to find. So he was happy, and then it turned out that that all the math was based on the assumption that the genome of one of these viruses was linear, and it turned out they were circular. and the circularity of the chromosome changed the mathematics entirely, and it sort of became trivial that it was going to be that the number of viruses involved in a mating was going to be two.
Well, that actually sort of tangentially brings me to my other question, and that's so you came out of Caltech as a phage geneticist, as a microbial geneticist, but I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the genetics that was done here at the UW and at Cal's was primarily oriented around agricultural genetics. Am I?
Well, so when I arrived in 1962 in Madison in genetics, there were two genetics departments. There was a Cal's genetics department and there was a medical genetics department. The medical genetics department had been formed by Joshua Lederberg, who was very much a basic geneticist. He was interested in basic microbial genetics. And he thought that the ag department of genetics was too agricultural, there were too many people in the department who were interested in applied genetics and breeding. And so he started this medical genetics department in the medical school, which was much more basic science than what was going on in Cal's. And then they started hiring more young people as Lederberg and the medical genetics department developed. And all of this hiring was done collectively by the genetics and medical genetics departments working together. And just before I got here, there was sort of a blow-up in which the production geneticists, the ones who were primarily interested in crop improvement and animal improvement, had a rather dramatic falling out with the basic geneticists in the department. And a lot of them just quit and went to the other departments. So there were people who left genetics and went to horticulture or agronomy or meat and animal science. And by the time I got here, a lot of the people who were left were the basic scientists, and the people who had gone were the production scientists. And many of them held joint appointments in genetics, but they were minority appointments. They'd be 85% horticulture, 15% genetics, that sort of thing. There was still a lot of hard feelings among the people in the faculty, but the department had more or less simmered down by the time I got here and acquired its modern state, which was that it had a representation of people who were interested in applied genetics, but for the most part they were basic scientists. So just a few months after I got here, we moved into the new genetics building, which is now called the old genetics building, just across the mall from here. And The plans for the building showed all kinds of people occupying space in the building who never moved into it. They had moved into horticulture and agronomy and so forth. And a bunch of new people moved into that building, which was designed for a very different kind of genetics from what we were doing there. So we had to retrofit a brand new building to fit a whole new plan. And we put in autoclaves and sterilizers, sterilizing ovens, and gas lines, and distilled water lines, and so forth, in order to be able to do biochemical molecular genetics.
And that was really basic. That's fairly basic equipment to outfit for a lab
like
that.
Yeah, but some of those labs were laid out so that you could put pelts from minks on them and line them up according to how much melanin they had in them and that sort of thing. They had hand cranked adding machines that they were using to do their statistical analysis. some of the better supported geneticists had electrically operated adding machines, but they were pretty, that was sort of cutting edge for them. And we needed ultracentrifuges and things like that in our laboratory. So we had to put in new power and a lot of new basic services in order to be able to do research.
So maybe the conflict leading up to this departure wasn't just about some intellectual style of genetics. It was about the really basic functional needs of a laboratory.
Yeah, it was.
Okay.
Dan, do you want to ask the question about the culture of cows research?
Sure. Okay. Yeah. I mean, so building on that, I suppose, what was it like being a researcher in cows or in genetics in the years after you got here? I mean, it might be helpful to say.
It was terrific. There were a lot of people who were interested in basic genetics and in biochemistry and bacteriology and in plant pathology. And I mean, there were people all over, and there were a number of people in the applied departments who were interested in basic problems in genetics, and there were people in zoology and botany who were interested in basic problems in genetics and molecular biology. So when I first got here, there were about a couple of dozen of us who formed a little seminar group. These were all at the faculty level. So there were a couple of dozen of us who met once a week in somebody's house. We'd drink beer and talk about what we were doing in our laboratories, and we would take turns talking about it wasn't a journal club. It was, what am I doing, and are any of you interested in collaborating with me, and do you have advice? I've got problems. Here are my problems. What do you think I can do to address those? Do you have methods at your disposal that might help me in my research? So it was really a big interdisciplinary collaborative group.
Miller, did that?
We met weekly.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Did that group change over time? I mean, obviously, as people sort of came in and out, but was there still a group over time that would meet?
There was a group for, I don't know, maybe, it didn't last forever, but it lasted for maybe five or so years. Mm-hmm. And it included people like Howard Temin and Harlan Halverson, who became the director of the Institute for Molecular Biology, and Gary Borsi and Julius Adler. I mean, there were a lot of terrific scientists who were members of this group, mm-hmm. Bob Auerbach. And we talked about everything from immunology in mice to genetics of bacterial viruses.
Do you recall early on if any of this these formal and informal meetings led to direct collaborations with you and someone in that group?
Oh, yeah, they did. I mean, I used to have lab meetings with people from other departments, and we would talk about our research. We didn't do very much active collaboration, but I, for example, did a joint project. It was a very small one with Walter Fitch once. Walter was one of the pioneers of sequence analysis to understand molecular evolution. And at the time, nobody could sequence nucleic acids, but Walter was comparing protein sequences across the kingdoms to try to use protein sequences to determine evolutionary trees. And we got together and isolated some bacterial viruses and did some protein sequence analysis on those to see how they fit into the kingdoms of plants and animals. For many years, Bill McLean and I had joint meetings, and Dave Pratt and I. Dave Pratt was a phage geneticist in the bacteriology department when I first came here. Had joint meetings of our laboratory group, so we exchanged information. We didn't very often do work together because Dave Pratt, for example, was working on a single-stranded DNA virus called M13. I was working on a double-stranded DNA virus called T4. These were very different kinds of systems to work in, but we exchanged lots of ideas. And the same went for Bill McLean when he was working on the same virus I was working on, so, and he was doing incredible molecular analysis that sort of blew me away. I was not yet in his league as a researcher, I must say, but it was exciting to hear what was going on in his lab.
So, Millard, you were on campus for quite some time. How did that, you said that group lasted about 5 or 10 years, but how did research change historically? You know, specifically for you, but maybe for others in CALS, was there still that sort of either formal or informal collaboration as time went on?
Yeah, there was a lot of formal and informal collaboration that went on. I think it still goes on. It's just one of the nice things about the University of Wisconsin is that it does have good flow of information. You keep hearing top-level administrators here talk about how we all work in these silos and we're isolated from people in other departments. But in fact, in the sciences, we haven't been isolated from people in other departments. We've had very good communication among people in the science departments, and we've had very good interactions so that my graduate students would go to people in the medical school to use equipment if they needed an electron microscope or something like that that we didn't have in our department. They'd find someone who would let them use their equipment. And there was no charge. There was no complaint. I once had an undergraduate who was a bit psychotic, and he took over somebody else's lab and threw out a freezer full of equipment of specimens before anybody knew what was happening. That was kind of a... I must say I got complaints then. But for the most part, he got to do that because, having come from my lab, he said he was working in my lab, which he was not, and he used my name, and he got access to this guy's laboratory and trashed it before the guy called up and said, "What's going on here?" And I said, "What are you talking about?" So yeah, there's very good interaction among laboratories at the University of Wisconsin.
So far there's been a former advisor who is an SOB, at least one psychotic graduate student.
Undergraduate, excuse me,
and a wealth of possible follow-up questions, but I don't know if I want this interview restricted for 50 years.
I'm throwing out these little...
Dan, do you have anything else you want to ask about research before we move to teaching?
Let's move to teaching.
Okay.
Yeah.
And let's just start with your overall philosophy for undergraduate biology education.
Well, my overall philosophy for education at any level is that you have to get students excited about what they're studying, and you have to face the fact that you can't really teach anybody much, that they have to learn things, and that learning involves a lot of work. So I have had often on course evaluations, I've had students say, "You didn't teach me anything. Everything I learned in this course, I had to learn for myself," which always kind of made me happy because I figure if you learn anything, by God, you had to learn it for yourself. But I think my model as a wonderful teacher that I had as an undergraduate was a man named Barry Commoner at Washington University. Barry Commoner was an extremely wild scientist. I mean, he would try anything, do anything, He liked far out hypotheses. He was very combative. I mean, he wouldn't accept anybody's interpretation of an experiment until the experiment had been nailed down a dozen different ways. And so you could keep going back to him and say, well, look at this and this and this evidence, and he'd say, well, I can think of alternative explanations, and he'd make you work some more. That was what my SOB professor at Caltech did too. He was even more famous for that than Barry. But Barry Commoner taught a course in physiology in which he would come in and give wild, wonderful lectures. I mean, he was so exciting as a lecturer. It was a delight to sit and listen to him. But when it came to tests, he would ask you questions that were almost incomprehensible, certainly unanswerable, and he'd give you 48 hours to hand in the answers. Was take-home exams, and you'd go, and he would leave the library open, make arrangements for the library and the zoology department to be left open 24 hours a day for 2 days. And everybody went up to the library and started looking for answers to questions like, explain the physiological properties of carbon dioxide in terms of its quantum mechanical properties. And you didn't have any notes on the physiological effects of carbon dioxide, and you certainly didn't have any notes on the quantum mechanical properties of carbon dioxide, and then you go to the library and start looking through all the books that were there and order in pizza because there wasn't really time to go out and get anything to eat. And the whole class was there working together trying to understand these questions that Barry asked and figure out plausible answers to them, and we were supporting one another, working collaboratively, learning a tremendous amount in a very short time and kind of getting a little bit more confident about our ability to find information and to make sense out of it, even when we were reading things that were really beyond the level of the course, beyond our own backgrounds. But it was exciting stuff. And when you wrote your answers and you handed them in to Barry, you had the feeling that you had really been through an experience. This was kind of boot camp for scientists. It was crawling through mud, climbing over high obstacles, whatever, working together, trying to make sure that nobody died along the way. It was exciting. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the way I did my teaching, I have to admit. So I would give students take-home questions as study questions to support the lectures I gave in class that were pretty difficult questions and that required a lot of work. I assumed generally that they'd work together. That's the kind of exams I gave in the graduate courses I taught, take-home exams. You'd get 2 weeks to do the take-home exam. I tried a lot of different ways of getting people to work on those. Sometimes, you know, you could talk to each other, but you couldn't write together. Sometimes you could hand in a jointly authored paper if you wanted to share a grade. You could do that. So over the years, I tried a number of different ways of getting people to work on their own. But anyway, that was my philosophy of education, was that it's a matter of digging in, working hard, figuring out things that you didn't think you could figure out, and getting the satisfaction out of that exercise that comes only of working harder and doing things that you thought were impossible.
Miller, do you know if you talked about you had a mentor, so to speak, who you learned to teach from. Do you have graduate students here, former graduate students here, that you helped not only to how to do research but how to teach? Did you try to pay your mentorship forward, so to speak?
Well, I taught a lot of undergraduate classes here, and had TAs in those classes that I tried to work with. Every course I taught, except for my microbial genetics course, which I taught solo, I taught with a team. And so I taught general genetics, and I taught BioCore, and I taught advanced genetics in team-taught courses. And you're pretty much constrained when you're teaching with a team to do what the team wants to do. So if you do things that are too far out, you either make the students angry because you're not doing what the other professors in the course are doing, or they're either angry at you or they're angry at them. And I had both kinds of students, I'm happy to say. Some of them thought I was the one who ought to be thrown out of the teaching group, and some of them thought that other members of the teaching group should be thrown out. So students have different reactions to different teachers. But so I can only say that I hope that in interacting with students I gave them something to help them.
Do we have time to ask about the administrative? You were dean of the medical one of the deans.
I was
of the medical,
an associate dean of the medical
associate
school.
Associate dean of the medical school. What was it like to look at the way the school was run, or the way certain things were taught, or how research was done from different ends of the campus? So you were coming from, genetics is uniquely positioned as both a medical and an agricultural endeavor here.
Yeah.
But there are, if you could say something about the demands that were put on you as a dean for a college that was quite different. I don't know if that's quite the right way of phrasing it. But.
Well, I was. I was one of several associate deans, so I had a range of responsibilities, most of which I was unqualified to do. I should say, I was the principal business officer of the medical school for a number of years. I had absolutely no background in business and no background in accounting and no interest in those things. So, so I delegated my responsibilities to my assistant deans. In the area of financial administration. I was at the same time associate dean for research and associate dean for personnel and associate dean for space and associate dean for graduate studies in the medical school. So that was sort of a large portfolio of activities which didn't all fit together real well. And I was most interested in the graduate studies and the research. So I chaired a research committee. We had money in the medical school to hand out to faculty members for startup research projects. And we had a medical school research committee that received grant applications from faculty and could give out grants in the, the $10,000 to $25,000 range. And I chaired that committee for many years, and we gave out a lot of money to deserving young faculty to help them get started and get preliminary experiments done so that they could then apply for extramural support for their research. I helped to start up an MD-PhD program in the medical school, which is still in existence and still thriving. I was one of several faculty members who collaborated. Mike Fan and John Fallon and I together started up this MD-PhD program. And it's a big deal. I mean, it takes a long time to get both degrees, so you have to go to medical school and graduate school for 7 or 8 years and write a real PhD thesis while getting a real medical degree at the same time. A lot of my time was devoted to personnel, just hearing grievances and dealing with requests for new positions and that sort of thing. So how was it? Well, it was a lot of busy work and a lot of dealing with When grievances come to the level of the dean's office, if they haven't been resolved in the department, they're usually getting pretty hot. So I had to deal with lots of angry people who really wanted to strangle one another and wanted to pass on that duty to me. And then I would try to explain to them that wasn't my job, that my job was to try to resolve conflicts. And resolving conflicts is very difficult work. I was also acting dean of the School of Allied Health Professions for a couple of years. I was the last dean of that school. And my job there was to essentially to put that school out of its misery. It was an underfunded school, bunch of departments that were that had a hard time interacting with one another because they were so diverse in their interests that they didn't have much in common. So mostly they competed with one another rather than working together. There was occupational therapy, physical therapy, medical technology, and physician assistant programs. And as I say, they were all underfunded and understaffed. And they were excellent programs, individually excellent programs. So anyway, we disassembled the school and farmed out the departments to other units of the university, so they all still exist, but there is no longer a School of Allied Health Professions. That was a traumatic experience.
SOB professor, psychotic undergrad, killing a department.
School.
Schools. Yeah, not just a department, excuse me, a school, whole school. Again, lots of places we could go. Dan, I think you were itching to ask a follow-up question there.
A little bit. I mean, you weren't able to keep up with your... Did you have your own lab operating when you were an administrator as well?
I didn't.
Okay.
I was chair of genetics for 14 years. And I managed to run a lab for about 11, I think, of those 14 years. And then it just became too much for me. Being a department chair is a big job, and I was chair of two departments. And then when you're chair of a department, you become sort of visible to the dean's office, and you end up serving on committees of the school. So I was serving on committees of the medical school and committees of the College of Agriculture because I was chair of genetics and chair of medical genetics. And it had gotten to the point where I was breaking appointments to meet with my graduate students. I felt that I was really neglecting people who needed my attention. And I finally just decided that I couldn't continue to run a lab and be an administrator at the same time, and closed my lab with tears in my eyes. As I look back, I think, you know, if I had been planning my life knowing what I know now, I would not have become a department administrator when I became a department administrator. I liked doing research, and I should have spent much more time doing it. And as it happens, teaching and administrating and doing research can't all coexist in the same life.
If you could open up a lab again, what would you want to work in? Is there something in genetics these days that gets you really excited and makes you want to try some experiments out, do some work?
Well, I think there's a lot of interesting, exciting work going on in developmental genetics and in neurogenetics, and there. It's easy to get lost in the details of genetics is becoming, and everything else, biochemistry and genetics and molecular biology are all becoming kind of the same thing, and they're all dealing with these enormously complicated interacting systems, and I don't know whether it's going to be possible to analyze all of those complicated interacting systems and make sense of them. But that's what people are trying to do right now, to look at protein-protein interactions in these enormous balls of things that are connected to one another with lines that show some reaction velocity or some equilibrium constant and that sort of thing. And it's just, it's dazzling. But it seems very exciting to me. I think if I were getting back into research, I would want to get back into something that had to do with development or neural function.
Is class 50 minutes?
Yes.
Okay. So I think we want to make sure we asked to get your thoughts about this course specifically, your thoughts about the importance of this course and having it taught.
Well, you know, I think the main thing about history courses is that they emphasize the way ideas come into existence and the way they develop, and they emphasize that this is a human activity. I think students tend to get the idea that science is what's written in a textbook and that it's all done, and that if you learn everything that's in the textbook, you know science. And they forget that there's still, in the first place, an awful lot left to learn, and in the second place, that all of that stuff that's in the textbooks was done by real people, some of whom were SOBs, some of whom were a lot of fun to work with, and that there are wonderful stories to tell about how we got to know what we know. So I think the value of history is to reveal to you how we know what we know, to encourage you to wonder whether we really know what we know, because the paths that we followed are all fraught with potholes and byways that can lead you off into never never land, and somehow or other you have to realize that it is people who do this stuff, and you can do it, and it's exciting to get involved in it when you get involved in it at the level of being in a research lab and doing things. So both for the purpose of letting people understand, remember, driving home the point that it's an activity that comes out of human heads and human effort. I think even people who aren't going to become scientists need to understand something about how science is done. Understand that it isn't done by those mad scientists that tend to populate the movies, but it's done by people who really are earnestly trying to understand how the world works and who are earnestly trying to use knowledge to make it a better world in which to live. So that's what history is all about. That's what I think is the value of this course.
One last thing. This is the the tombstone question. Heaven forbid something happened to you on your way home, and I'm the last person, or we're the last person you hear from. If you could briefly talk about what you think your legacy is, or, you know, what might fit nicely on a tombstone.
Huh.
This is a knuckleball question I threw. I said I wasn't going to throw.
Well, I'll tell you, over the course of my life, I have received a few letters from students who have been in my classes and who have taken time after a long time to write to me and thank me for teaching them. And the letter that I liked the best was one from a student who said, you made us think, and I guess that's what it's all about. So if that's true, if I actually did that for a couple of people, I guess that maybe justifies having spent a career in teaching and research. So I would like to think that somebody might write as a little. I don't expect to have a tombstone, but you know, he made us think that would be nice.
Lord, I think I can speak for Dan and say thank you very much for giving us your time today. We appreciate it. So this concludes the interview with Millard Sussman for the UW-Madison Oral History Program.